He's a Foley.
He's a Foley.
It's my Foley.
You want to hear my helicopter?
I do want to hear your helicopter. That is so good. All right. And your flock of marathoners?
It's the same thing.
It isn't the same thing. Your flock of marathon. It's different. Yeah.
No, it's the same thing.
Is it?
Flock of marathoners, yep.
No. See, the marathoners have more air going. That's your... Yes, exactly. So it may be the same tongue action. Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, we're keeping gone that. There.
No, we...
On this week's episode of The Freenoter, we're going to take a little bit of a detour into the world of webinars now that we're all working from home.
Boy, are we. We're also going to look at how marketing props builds their virtual offerings into compelling and useful products.
And we will cure coronavirus on this show with a cocktail we call the Dr. Delore.
The Dr. Delore. All that and more on this week's episode of The Freenoter.
So we were originally going to do part two of our conversation about story.
And then we said, to heck with that, the world's falling apart.
That's right. It's Flush the Format Fridays.
Except it's Tuesday.
All That's right. Another format flushed. So we decided instead, because we've seen so many of our Keynoter and Freenoter, and I guess we're all doing free nopes now.
Free nopes. The Freenoper. So good. Yeah. Yep. Keynote.
Keynopes. Free nopes.
Free nopes.
Yeah, all of that. And, you know, we've seen a number of people pivot into webinars and virtual offerings and things like that.
Or at least attempt to.
At least attempt to. And I sense you have a strong opinion about this, Tamsin Webster.
Well, as do you. I mean, I think coronavirus aside, it's a good idea for any freenoter to understand how to do their thing virtually as well. But certainly my experience, and I'm guessing it's yours too, that live and virtual, not the same beast.
Yeah, it's the same conversation I've had with speakers about going into podcasting, that giving a great speech and being a great podcast host or a great interviewer, they're different skills.
Absolutely.
Having one does not give you the other.
Yes.
And I think being a great speaker does not necessarily translate immediately into being a great virtual presenter, a great webinar presenter.
100%.
I don't think.
Yeah, no, I don't. Because I agree, it's a different set of skills. You have to think differently about almost every aspect of both content and delivery. So I know I have my thoughts on this too, but I'm curious, what do you see as the great challenge, the great problem of virtual presentation? What is the real thing, the actual thing that we have to get, that we have to defeat in order to be successful?
Well, I think the principal thing is boredom. Boredom is an enormous issue for me when I watch webinars, and there's the transmission of information without the human element. And, you know, most webinars that I've seen don't have a video component. You don't actually see the person presenting, which I think does add a considerable amount. And, you know, we've started to add that more and more into our webinars. But I think most importantly, people that are incredibly lively and engaging and can draw people in all of a sudden start showing bullet points on a screen. And it's
no.
Good, it's good night nurse, because
and not in the good way.
And not a good night nurse. Sorry about that. You're my nurse, baby.
Oh, thanks, honey bun.
And it's almost like you start to like devolve into not the most entertaining version of yourself. And there's something I think it's easy to lose energy when you're doing a webinar. It's easy to lose that kind of connectedness and that high you get on stage when you're actually looking at the people you were talking to. And it's really crucial that you try to maintain that.
Yeah. I love that insight that it's yes, boredom, but what I'm hearing you say is that the real cause of that is that the speaker has forgotten that there's people out there. And I think that's, and it makes a ton of sense because, you know, no matter how you, like, whether you look forward to speaking in front of people or not, there is something about the energy and the adrenaline of actual people in front of you. Though I have to say, I had to do a virtual presentation the other day and I was like legit nervous. Like it's just been, and I think it's as much about all the things that could go wrong on a virtual presentation from a technology standpoint. But also for me, it absolutely is that lack of like in the room feedback. And yeah, people can be on the chat and give you that kind of feedback, but it's not the same, you know? So I will fully admit, it was part of a day long summit, kind of virtual summit on how to be a speaker. And I was originally asked to be the keynote. And so I prepared what was very much a keynote-y type thing, still fairly tactical. And kind of after giving it, I think it was a fine presentation. I'm happy with it, but I realized it really wasn't a good match for that day and for the way it needed to go. And I think I would have caught that a lot faster if I had been in the room. So, you know, that's one of those dangers. So I love this insight that you have that forgetting that the people, that the audience is still there when you present.
They're still there. And also I think there's this tendency and, you know, I think about the webinars that I've done in the past that maybe I'd like to have back, you get caught up in reading your own screen. You get caught up in sort of being a narrator of the slides you're presenting and not treating it like it's a confidence monitor. It's staring you right in the face. And so you can kind of get caught up in, here's what this slide says, here's what this slide says. And I think one of the best things you can do if you're going to do these things is treat your screen like it's a confidence monitor. Stand up, have it just outside of, or just to your, you know, peripheral vision, and give a performance. Maybe you're giving that performance to your closet. Maybe you're giving it to your refrigerator. But if you fixate on having the screen in front of you, you know, 4 inches before your nose, you're going to get caught up in just kind of reading your slides. And that's kind of dangerous.
Well, particularly if your slides have bullets and all the copy on them, which I strongly recommend against on a webinar. And I, you know, come at me with this. I'm sure there's people that are going to be like, no, you should put all the details on the slides. But man, like the thing is, when you're in a live performance, right, or you're in a live talk, part of the value of being there is the energy you get from that person, right? But even with a live presentation, if somebody, what they're saying is essentially exactly what's on the screen, you have this question of, why are you here? If all you're going to do is read to me on the slides, well, I can read the slides faster than you can speak them. And so particularly on a webinar, that's why I think it's absolutely deadly to have like exactly what you're going to say on the slides, because they're going to be even more bored because they can scan the slide. They can decide really quickly if they need to listen to you or not. And probably they're not going to. So, I mean, the way I've always thought about virtual presenting is that the greatest enemy there is multitasking, right? That's what boredom leads to, right? If somebody's bored, they're going to start doing other stuff. And I think that if you only focus on like, oh, well, of course they're going to pay attention to my thing. No, they're not. No, they're not. Because we're human and we're wired to engage all of our senses. And if you're not engaging all of their senses, then their attention is going to start to wander.
So here's a spicy hot take, and you may disagree with this. I'd be curious about your reaction to this. I think if you're doing a webinar and it's not just, you know, a video of you on the screen, which is kind of a different dog, but let's assume that you are using slides of some kind. I think you need more of them than you think you do.
Oh, 100%.
And I have heard people say, well, I only need 4 or 5 slides, or I don't talk with slides or whatever. That's fine. But if I don't have something to look at, I'm going to go make a turkey sandwich.
Right. And if I don't think, and if what I have to look at is either not interesting or not valuable or not necessary to me, then you're right. A turkey sandwich it is. So, I mean, I operate on this concept that we all know, that you can't do two things at once. So my approach to virtual presenting is to consume as many of their senses simultaneously as possible. So we have to take taste and smell off the table.
Do we though?
Maybe not.
What if I mail you that turkey sandwich?
Oh.
Doesn't it smell delicious?
It does. It does. But we have at the very least our eyes, our ears, and the hands that you can consume that you can actually use to your advantage in a virtual presentation. And this idea of movement is one of the key ways in my mind to recapture the attention of the eyes. If they see a slide move, their eyes are going to be drawn to it. But that's another reason not to put so much detailed bullet information on your slide, because it means the slide is going to be up longer. So super simple. It's just reduce the information on the slides to the point where you've got one point per slide and you're going to be flying through.
I don't really want to get into kind of recommending a platform, but I will say, you know, at Edison, we do a lot of webinars on GoToWebinar. Mm. And one of the things that you get from that, and I don't know if you get that from Zoom or not. I know, Tamsin, you do a lot of work on Zoom.
Yeah.
You get attention metrics from GoToWebinar.
You can, I think, do that. That's a setting on Zoom that you can get. I haven't experimented with it. I believe that's an option on Zoom.
But those are like the most brutal and helpful speaker evaluations that you can look at.
I bet.
You know, GoToWebinar at least will keep track of, all right, did they minimize the window? Is there another window in focus? Are they doing something else?
Oh, wow.
And you get all of that information. And so you get, you know, it all boils down into like an attentiveness percentage.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and I try to shoot for 90 plus in that.
Yeah.
You have to understand that people are going to be multitasking. That's in some cases why they're able to participate at all.
Yes.
So you can't. You're never going to get 100 there.
I still want to dominate their senses, though, right? And I think there's a couple of ways, like even with the eyes and this movement piece. You know, we've talked about one of them, which is keep the slides moving and what you know, and keep those things moving. You talked about being on camera, yeah, which I highly recommend because again, it's another source of movement. I think I just recently discovered a way to be like kind of like the gamers do on Twitch, silhouette yourself in front of your slides. I'm going to experiment with that next, because that's actually in my mind like a dream scenario where I'm outlined kind of in the bottom left corner, where you see me on the slide simultaneously, where I'm not up in a corner. And because you're human, right? So one of the things that means, of course, is if you're going to be on camera, you had already talked about lifting the camera up so that the camera is roughly at eye level. Another thing, which is super, super simple, is just look into the camera and not at the picture of yourself.
That's the worst.
It is the worst.
A rookie move.
Put the picture of yourself, either minimize it. Sometimes if you minimize it, it actually stops your video. So you have to be careful about that. But put it someplace where you actually won't look at it. Or if you look at it, if you're going to put it someplace and you can move it right under the camera. So at least you're like super close to looking at the camera while you stare at yourself. But really the best thing to do is just really train yourself to look into the camera and not at anything else.
Well, I mean, that's kind of where my advice to treat it like a confidence monitor comes in. What you should be looking at the camera as much as possible. And when you're not, it's because you need to like quickly reacquaint yourself with the slide, just like you do on stage.
Absolutely.
Why are you looking at yourself?
That's right.
You actually don't need to look at yourself. You know what you look like, even though it's in reverse.
That's right.
You know what you look like. So,
A trick there is actually to uncheck or to check your mirror myself piece, because I see a lot of people do this on webinars or whatever. I understand why you leave it unchecked, because it means that you can move more naturally. You can gesture to the right, you know, where the right, your right is their right kind of thing. But it also means if you ever want to hold up something that has text on it, it's immediately clear that you've been reversed. So I'd actually prefer people train themselves to reverse their own perspective. And so that your left becomes their right and your right becomes their left. And so that you're able to gesture that way.
So I have another spicy hot take.
Okay, spicy hot take.
And
go.
I'm fortunate that I'm able to do this because I work for a company with very talented people. But you must never forget, if you're a speaker, freenoter or keynoter, that when you are on stage, you are being supported by multiple people.
Yes, and so true in a virtual environment.
You are being supported by an AV team.
Yeah.
Probably two or three people. You're being supported by the host. You're being supported by the MC of the event. You're being supported by the producer. You're being supported by the graphics team and just the production value of the stage, all of that. And if you attempt to do a webinar by yourself, you will not have those things.
That's true.
You will not have those things. And the really sort of high production value webinars, and they're not all that way, but the ones that we do at Edison, There's five or six people working on
it. 100%. Yeah, you have to to make it look seamless, you have to have enough people to fill in the seams. And usually that's really hard for one person to do.
Really, really hard. Yeah. I mean, we have people that are, you know, when we're going back and forth between video and slides, you know, we have Steve Lemma, who's using a software called Wirecast to cut back and forth. And, you know, we have people that in sight of us, giving us cues about the time. We have people feeding us questions. It really, to do something like Infinite Dial, which is one of our biggest webinars every year, there's five or six people working on it, looking at social, feeding stuff to us, because it's all that you can do actually giving the webinar to not trip over your words and to be on the right slide. It's like all you can do.
That's so true. That's so true. And so I think if we're also thinking about how do you as a speaker stay engaged, I mean, one of the ways to... So I know that for a lot of people, it's kind of an uncomfortable habit to, at least in the beginning, to build, to like stare into the camera. I just like to think of the camera as who's on the other end of it, because that way, then it's just like, I just know that that's the portal. I may not see them, but I know that there's somebody else on the other end of the camera. So stop looking at the camera as a camera and look at it as a person, and that you're actually, because there is a person on the, there's a whole bunch of people on the other side of it. To me, that's a really great way to kind of keep that energy up. But I also find that another key way to keep that energy up is to, you know, just as much as you're trying to like, you know, this whole multitasking thing, I think people try to think that, okay, let me minimize the multitasking. And in my mind, it's actually, no, you want to maximize their multitasking, but all with your content, right? So back to this idea of their senses, you know, there's the eyes, which you can capture with movement. And I think there's a lot we can talk about focus, like how can you focus their attention? How can you use slides to do that? But there's also, in my mind, this way of capturing their hands, you know, put something in their hands that they have to reference, like a handout or a worksheet.
Turkey sandwich.
only if you're building that into your presentation. And there's, I think, things we can do with our ears too. So, but this question of focus, like what, I know you and all the fine folks at Edison, you have, and we've talked a lot about this on the slides episode, so go listen to that. But how do you see the use of slides as being either different or the same when it comes to, other than the number of them, which we've already talked about, like what are things people can do to help with focus on the slides?
Yeah, I mean, I make the slides really, really simple. I do use more of them. As I mentioned before, but like every slide to me has to tell an extremely simple story. And I think that, and honestly, Tamsin, you do this better than I do, is to take, you know, I present a lot of data, and a data slide can be complex. There can be a lot of things happening. And, you know, in a presentation, you can, you might accomplish that with builds. You might accomplish it with voiceover. But I try to fragment those slides, and what, you know, might be a complex slide in a webinar will become four slides.
Yes.
And I will not try to tell a multi-stage or a multifaceted story on one slide. I will atomize it a little bit more than I might when I can linger.
Yes.
Right. And in a stage presentation, you can linger a bit because you are the focal point. And I can say, you know what, this slide is going to take me 3 minutes to explain, and I'm going to do it with a great story. And but for a home audience in a webinar, they're staring at that same thing for 3 minutes.
That's
not good.
4 minutes
or 5 minutes, and that's not good.
Yeah.
But it still takes me time to explain it.
Right.
And so I'll atomize it.
Right. So what I do, for instance, even if I'm, let's say, putting up a model, right? So I'll put up the axes first, and then that's one slide where just the axes go up. And then the next slide is the labels of the axes. And the next slide is the next piece. And the next slide, you know, so that, yeah, to put up an entire model. So it might take me 5 or 6 slides. And I did that actually in the presentation I did on Saturday. I normally tell the story of De Beers and De Beers diamonds and whatever. And it's a story that usually on stage, like all I have behind me is the De Beers diamonds logo. I don't have to go into detail, but for doing it for a webinar, I actually like drew a supply and demand curve. And I showed like, because these are the details of what I'm talking about. But to be able to put it on screen allows people to focus and to really, really crystallize in that time that you've got with them on what you're trying to get them to really focus on. So I think that's a really key thing, is making sure that the slides are easy to read and to see. So I typically have very simple slides anyway. They're usually very, very, color blocked, highly graphic, full bleed images, as long as I can get the images to survive at that scale. But I think one of the other ways to use them, one of the ways I use them particularly on virtual, is I use them as almost like references to a more detailed document somewhere else. And so I mentioned consuming their hands with a handout. I never do a virtual presentation without a handout. And what I mean by a handout is, and I mentioned before, but at least a worksheet. But what I've been doing recently is kind of full notes from the presentation, which helps me as a speaker, honestly, because those, that writing out that handout, those notes, gives me a starter for my script that I'm going to put in the presenter notes on screen. But what I do with the slides is that I make sure that they're referencing, you know, that they link, so that, you know, I may have a heading on my slide, for instance, is that say, it, you know, for instance, your message is a map, and that ties into a section on the document where it says, you know, messages and ideas aren't the same, and it starts to go into those pieces, right? So that there's a relationship between those two. And when people start to realize that you are constantly referencing that document, then they have that thing either in their hand or in the other, on another screen, and they're going back and forth. And it becomes very difficult for them to multitask with anything else but your content at that point. And that's intentional for me. It's like I make sure that I distribute that handout ahead of time. I put it in the chat box before. I say to them at the beginning, I'm going to be referencing this document. You're going to want to have it handy. If I have a chance to communicate with these folks in advance, I send it out in advance. I say print it out because I'm going to be referencing it. And the ability, the degree to which you can reference that document allows you to continue to help them focus their attention. And that's really what you're trying to do in a virtual webinar, is take as much control of their attention as you can.
So the concept of control brings me to kind of the last thing I want to get to before we get to some great examples. And I have my third and final very spicy hot take of the show.
That's a lot of hot.
It's a lot of,
it's like three pepper hot.
It's the Scoville rating is high. A million Scoville. It's the ghost pepper of spicy hot takes.
I can't wait for this one.
Well, it's a question for you.
Okay.
How do you handle, like, you are the queen of Q&A, like all of the years you spent doing Weight Watcher meetings where you're up there getting question after question. You're very good on stage with that. How do you handle Q&A on a webinar?
Q&A on a webinar is tough. It's super tough. So one of the things that I did on this virtual presentation on Saturday, which I think actually went pretty well, is that as I was writing out the handout for it and the notes, I thought to myself, where are key places where I can do polls? Because we had been specifically asked by the organizer, in this case, it was the National Speakers Association local chapter for New England, to make sure that we were doing that. And so I actually went through and I figured out where were key places kind of at fairly even intervals throughout the talk where I could pause and ask a poll question that was related to the content that I just gave. So, I mean, I set up the expectation for them early, like literally 30 seconds into the presentation. I was like, so this is what we're talking about. Let me just get a sense of who's out there. Where are you on this right now? So the presentation was on how to find the core message of, in this case, your keynote, because I was speaking to speakers. And so one of my questions, literally 30 seconds in, where are you in this? Gave them five different choices and got where they were. So I also knew how to adjust kind of in the moment for the rest of the presentation for who my folks were. But I also set the expectation that I was going to be asking them questions. And so, you know, I went back and forth between, you know, five answer ones and yes, no, but by referencing the information I just gave, again, it was another way to make sure that I was keeping them tied in. So one way is polls. I don't necessarily love them, but they do work. Another is to ask people questions on the fly and say, put them in the chat. So for instance, I had an image. We've talked about this before, the rabbit duck illusion, the duck bunny. And when I do this live, I've learned in the moment to just before I say the name of the illusion, because I don't want to tell people what's in it, I just put it up and I say, there are two animals here. Which one do you see first? And then in that one, I just said, put in the chat, which one you see first. And so one way to do that is really is to kind of use multiple sources, use polling, use Q&A, have them put it in chat. A great tip, frankly, that I learned from others on that same virtual summit that we did was call people out by name. Like, oh, I see, Matt, you said duck. You know, most people do see the duck first. And I think that's a great way to do it, too. With all of these things, the more that you can mimic the in-person experience, I think the better it is. And so, you know, those aspects of voice and how you address the audience are really my third thing for I think how to really kind of maximize that multitasking. And that's what can you do with people's ears? So asking them questions, like our brains are attuned to the upward tick of a question. And maybe you're like, wait, was I supposed to answer a question? So that's one thing. But there's also an incredible effect, and you can hear it on podcasts particularly, of the pause. And it was funny, you know, I heard somebody this weekend say, you know, avoid the pause at all costs. And I'm like, what are you talking about? The pause is like, the pause is gold. Like if somebody all of a sudden hears you stop talking, their concern was that people would think that something happened to the audio. Fine. It means that they've snapped back attention to you. So I think, I know one of the things that I try to do when I'm presenting live is make sure that I'm conscious about my use of pauses. So you're so good on audio, but what are some of the things that you do to really capture people's ear attention on these virtual presentations?
Yeah. I mean, you just named, I think, one of the most important things, and that is to use people's names as much as you can. Yeah. I'm very conscious and attentive to the chat box when I'm doing a webinar. And also I'll follow the hashtag for the webinar. And so I will call out people's names and I'll read their questions and I might name 20 people in the course of a webinar just so that they know I'm paying attention, right? I will say this, in another life before the witness protection program, I spent a lot of time.
What was your name before?
Zachariah Schneflagus.
Schneflagus.
Yes.
Because that's, okay.
Abraham Kalasnovsky Bumstein Pastor Fazula.
Okay.
In that other life, I did a lot of work and consulting and research on a bunch of like big morning shows, right? I've worked with Elvis Duran. I've worked with Howard Stern. I've worked with RuPaul when Ru had the morning show.
She already done has hers.
You know, I'm gonna break some news here for listeners. If you're listening to, you know, Carlos and the Chicken and the Z Morning Zoo, Nut Hut, whatever, and they're doing listener calls, they're doing prank calls or whatever.
Oh, I know this. I won't spoil it.
If they have a listener call in and tell a story, they had 10 listeners call in and tell a story, and 9 of them did not make the cutting room floor.
They dropped to the cutting room floor.
They actually off the air would do 9, 10, 15 different calls. They would pick the best one and they would edit it.
Yeah.
And so that person who calls in who's so excited, it's because like 9 more weren't that excited.
Yeah. So is that what you're doing with questions in the chat?
I never do live questions. I never have people's voices.
You never do live questions.
Yeah, I never have people's voices because even more so than a live speech somewhere, you are the shepherd. You are the caretaker of that 30 minutes or that 60 minutes.
And by the way, please don't make it any longer than that.
Oh, God, no. No. Otherwise, you should get college credits. but if you are the caretaker of that 30 minutes, you have to consider all 30 of those minutes as your content and in your control. And people aren't necessarily, you know, we've all been to conferences where you open it up for questions. And the first question is, hi, I'm Chad Chadley with Craply.com, and we're an enterprise service provider of solutions as services that provide serviceable solutions to the solution services community. And what we have found is, like, you can't have that on your, you cannot have that on your webinar.
Have we had a Q&A episode?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, we should do one. So don't, yeah, absolutely. Because there's, I think between the two of us, we have a lot. So I would say that's excellent. And you're right.
You're saying to hold my powder on that.
Hold your powder on that.
And this is what I get for allowing another voice on my podcast. I lose control.
No, but the point is still true, which is
the point is true,
which is when you give people a stage, they will take it. But I think there's let's hold the specific details on Q&A for let's do a show just on Q&A because you and I
fine tamp down my passions.
I'm the worst.
You are the worst.
I am the worst.
I love you, though.
Oh, I adore you. All right. So let's do like a lightning round. What would be your top three things that you would say would make for a better virtual presentation?
Script everything.
That's a good one.
Script everything. Yep. When I do the infinite dial, I have a script.
Yes. 100%. And God, please, for the love of God,
write it like you speak it. And speak it and have it transcribed.
Absolutely. Or at least, very least, if you're going to write it, read it out loud. Because all of a sudden, you're going to find that this like beautifully crafted written sentence like sounds like crap. And you run out of air.
Yep.
When you're trying to say it. All right. So script it.
Script it. Have someone help you. A spouse, a friend, a business partner. Have someone keeping an eye on the store so you can focus on your performance. Because if you are both the performer and your own AV tech at the same time, your mind is going to wander. You're not going to be able to give 100% to the performance.
Yes, 100%.
So there's that. And the third thing, be very conscious of the fact that you visually cannot hold people's attention, and be creative about slides. And, you know, unless you're really just going to stand up and give have a video of yourself recorded, try to atomize your thoughts a little bit more. Try to have a little more motion on the screen. Try to give people multiple, as you said, Tamsin, engage multiple senses. So those would be my three things.
Yeah. Oh, I love those. Yeah. I think some of mine probably at this point would be tactical because it probably gave all the way. I would agree with so much. I mean, one is in that scripting, build in that naturalness, right? So make sure that it's spoken English, but mark your pauses, put your presenter notes in such a way that you actually naturally have to speak them differently. So, and this is part of how I recommend people script or create their notes regardless. Bullets, 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 and never, never cross more than two lines. Mm. Like it just so, like it, no paragraphs of text ever, because when you're trying to, for all the things that we're talking about, if you're looking at the camera and you're just dipping down quickly as a confidence monitor, no, you are not going to be able to find your place in a paragraph. Absolutely. So bullets, 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 even more reason to have many, many slides. So that 45 minute presentation that I did had 91 slides. I was flying through them because it was about building those pieces. Number two, I would say, would be still related to how can you make this as natural as possible. Realize that in that scope of the video of you, you have a lot of power. And I don't know what our official body language experts like Nick Morgan or Mark Bowden would say to this, but one of the things that I know I've adjusted to when I do virtual presenting is I've moved my gestures up. Mm. So that when I'm presenting on camera, like my gestures are all kind of next to my face, which in live performance is actually not where you want them, because that's a lot of like high stress. Like that's, you're really emphasizing if your hands are up by your face. But what I've really found is that like I've shrunk the scale and the scope of where the body language happens. So something that would normally be at waist height now is like right under my chin. Like something that would be at my face is at my face, and something that would be high is like right at the top of my head. But I really try to keep my gestures in camera view, because again, it's another way to keep that motion going. It's your head, somebody's off making a turkey sandwich, doesn't move that much, but your hands do. So put your hands in camera view, and I'm like gesturing you as if
you are.
We're on camera. Yeah, I know, you're like, you are a freak.
And tonight's episode, by the way, is brought to you by turkey sandwiches. Turkey sandwiches. What can't they do?
I think the third thing would be just to double down on what I think is the unsung hero of all presenting, the handout. Handouts are your friend. And if this is full credit, this is something I learned from the fine folks at Aratium and from Tim Pollard. Handouts allow you to take that detail that you would typically put on your slides and put it someplace else. And it allows you to actually maximize what you as a speaker are there to do, which is to give color, to entertain, to inform, and to capture their attention for however long you have them. And let the handout be where the detail lives. You can speak it, don't put it on the slides, put it on the handout. And being able to separate those two allows people to really just sit back and engage, because they know they don't have to. It's not that they don't have to pay attention, because again, of all the things we were talking about before, you're referencing all these things back and forth. But to free them up from taking notes allows them to really engage with what you're saying. And that's gold in a virtual presentation.
So I want to get to, we promised at the top of the show, a cure for coronavirus. And so I want to get to that. But before we do, who does a good job with webinars? Who would you point to?
Well, I know you won't point to this group, but I can. And that is, I think Edison Research does a spectacular job with webinars. And I know, I mean that. And you did not pay me in cocktails to say that. I would say that regardless, because you all do really great things. You don't do handouts. I can't fault you for that. But there's, you all experiment constantly with what's working. This is what I respect. You use what works. You keep what works. You alter what doesn't. You go back and forth with formats. You all do such a beautiful job of integrating video in virtual presentations, which is really freaking hard. And that goes back to the great team that you were talking about before. You've got great people who produce that video, but also people who are able to switch that stuff on the fly. And when you take into account that you all are doing that with some of the hardest information to present, which is data, I got to tell people, like, just, you want to see a great virtual presentation, period, go look at what Edison does, because you make the complex simple. You make it fun. I mean, the infinite dial is great. I mean, you have this wonderful, you and John Rosso have this beautiful dad joke, repartee.
We have, but big dad energy.
But even big dad energy. That's right. But even it's is it Meg that does the Moms in Media?
There's a whole team. Nicole, yeah, Megan, yeah. Melissa. Yeah.
So I mean, just Johanna. But it's not. And the reason why I say Edison is because it isn't just you that does great webinars for Edison. Like, the whole team does great webinars and great free noting generally. So I say you all. An unpaid placement. You That's all are a kind. great example of that.
I would also point out the work that Marketing Profs does, and I've done.
They are so good.
They're really, really good, and I've done some webinars for Marketing Profs, and they do a thing which the first time I did it felt very unnatural, but it grew on me. Mm. And I have to admit that some of the webinars that I have done in the past 2 years have not been live.
What?
In fact, last year, I did a webinar called the Podcast Consumer 2019. And at the exact moment that I was giving the webinar, I was in Chicago in an agency meeting.
I remember this.
And I was freaking the F out because I couldn't see it. I didn't know if it was playing and working and all that. But Marketing Profs actually has you pre-record the webinar and then come on live for the Q&A. So there is a live element. People know that you're there. And essentially, you're just sitting there for, you know, 25 or 50 minutes or whatever, watching yourself give the content. But you know what? After you get over the sort of initial awkwardness of that, it's actually a fantastic production and presentation, because you can devote yourself to the performance, knowing that if you need to cut in something else or redo it, you can.
Yeah.
You can make the performance perfect.
Yeah, you sacrifice on the in presentation ability to interact.
Correct.
But yes. So that's the trade-off, but sometimes that's the right trade-off. So, you know, I think that's an important thing, is that it's not interact at all costs or what you have to your point earlier about, like, it often takes a team. I think sometimes you have to stop and think about what resources do you have and what are you actually capable of? Because I would 100% sacrifice in the moment interaction for a watchable webinar. 100%. So, like, if you don't feel confident in your ability to manage that in the moment interaction, don't do it. Put the focus on the content and then find some other way to answer those questions later. Like, as you all do with the Infinite Dial, have people ask questions on Twitter or on your Facebook page or whatever. Like, take the conversation offline, which, by the way, way better way to engage those people in the future.
Much better. Yeah.
Hello.
That scales.
Yeah. And people can see you interacting with those questions. So even more reason to take those questions offline. But I really, I would focus on the content, focus on the attention, focus on valuing the time of the people you're speaking to. And that's going to make for a great experience for you and for them every time.
Speaking of valuing the time.
Yes.
People have been waiting over a half an hour to get the cure for coronavirus.
Well, we can't cure it, but we can cure what you think about it.
Oh, shit. So, Tamsin, you did an investigation into plague waters.
I did.
So tell, what did you learn?
So this is fine. So in my, and we've mentioned this before, but part of my daily reading is to gather things for what I call my swipe file, which are interesting stories, articles, whatever. And I stumbled across one earlier this week on plague waters, which were tinctures. These were things that back in the days of the bubonic plague that people put together because they believed that drinking these things would help ward off the plague. So some beverages that we know and love actually began in the days of plague waters, green chartreuse among them, which was one of those things. Anyway, the article was about, we can link to it, was about a museum and a distillery that decided to recreate some of these plague waters, they just went deep into trying to do this. And then they created an actual cocktail based on the modern day equivalents of these various ingredients. And at the end of this article, they had a recipe for this cocktail, which horrifyingly they did not name. So we decided to make the cocktail, including the ingredients for the cocktail.
Yes.
So you were kind enough to make that. And then we went on the hunt for a good name for it.
We did. So the cocktail itself, and I'm not going to give the full recipe because it's, you have to make like a honey sage syrup and you need focus and will.
Focus and will. And a really, really well-stocked liquor store. there is a difficult to get ingredient.
There
in this.
Is. So there are two spirits in this and they are both sort of plague waters of a sort. There's green chartreuse, which we have used in a few recipes on this show, which has about 40 different herbs and spices in it.
Yeah.
It's a very complex recipe. And then one that was new to us, which is from the Czech Republic, called Bekarovka.
Yes.
And Bekarovka has another roughly 20 herbs and spices in it. So together, over 60, which is four times the Colonel's secret recipe, which I believe...
Well, they may overlap, but we don't know because it's all secret. Yeah.
Yeah, there may be some extra crispy in Bekarovka. I don't know. Bekarovka is a fairly strong spirit with it sort of has a cinnamon on the nose, a little bit of fennel. Yep. And it seems like when you smell it that it might be sweet, but
and
like
it
so
is
many
kind
things
of, yeah.
it has a bitter finish to it.
Yeah, so that's like me, baby. I'm sweet on the nose and bitter finish.
Don't I know it.
Well, it describes itself as an herbal liqueur, so
yeah.
Full stop. And props to I think it was called Tattersall's Distillery, and I believe it was the Minneapolis Institute of Arts that came up with this, that they found a way to mix these things in a way that I think that even if you don't think you love herbal liqueurs, and you still may not love this, but it really softens and rounds out the flavor here. So this drink is weird and good.
It's weird and good.
it's a
flavor you can't pin down.
And you've never had anything like
it. You've never had anything like it, but it's not bitter. There's a little lemon juice. There's a little pineapple juice. And like I said, there's that sage honey syrup that you make, which takes no time at all. And it's an indescribably complex, pleasant, and I am currently virus-free.
Clearly related. So as we mentioned, this was to us at least just critically, criminally without a name. It was just at the bottom of the recipe. Yeah. It calls a plague waters inspired cocktail, and I'm like, well, we can't call
name
it.
Name it.
I know. Name it. So I went researching, and I came up with some ideas, and I thought maybe it's the defender, maybe it's the antidote. And we settled on the last option that I presented to you, which was the Dr. Delorme. And the story behind the Dr. Delorme is, so back in the days of the plague, a lot of things associated with the plague are these famous
kind
of... Shout out to the plague. Are these beaked masks, right? These black bird masks. And I stumbled across this article on Mental Floss, will also be in the notes, that said that that beak mask actually wasn't present in the first waves of the bubonic plague. There's no evidence that it was there, but that several centuries later, in fact, in the reign of, I believe, Louis XIII in France, Dr. Delorme was the one who invented that beaked mask. So since that was a protector against the plague, we figured that the Dr. Delorme was a lovely name for this plague waters and kind of aqua mirabilis, again, another defender against the plague ingredient that this cocktail represents.
Yes. So shout out to Dr. Delorme. We know you're listening. Shout out to the Czech Republic. Shout out to Carlsbad.
And to the monks of Chartreuse.
And to the monks of Chartreuse who put all of these herbs and spices together in deliciously yet effective ways.
Yes.
To ward off the virus.
We love it.
On next week's episode of The Freenoter, we're going to return to our regularly scheduled programming with the continuation of our deep dive into the power of story.
We visit the work of our dear friend, Nick Morgan, and look at his theory of story structure and story type.
And we're going to make ourselves a truly terrible cocktail just to prove that we're still alive.
Oh, I'm so excited by that.
It's going to be bad.
All that and more on next week's episode of The Freenoter.
Cheers.
Cheers. We'll meet again. Don't know where, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.